Okay, so Herbert told me that the thing to emphasize is that anyone can do this. So okay, so I never thought I would give this talk to the Lattice community, but I guess seeing that most of the people, with one exception, are males, and I'm going to talk about prostate cancer, probably something you should take seriously. Okay, that's just to get you, now to get you cooled down. So Stan Leibler told me this joke. It's not a joke, it's a fact. It happened to him when he was interviewed. Well, he was not interviewed, he was offered this tenured position. He was invited over to Princeton, and then he was taken out by the biologists in the evening, and they said, well, over dinner, they said, there's one more question to ask you. So they said, if you throw a physicist and a mathematician off the Empire State Building, which one will hit the ground first? And of course, Stan didn't know. And they said, well, never mind. The real answer is, who cares? So biology has a perspective that is a little different from the one that we are used to. And ever since, well, since I became sick a few years ago, I've realized that there are something we can do actually in this field, and I'm going to show you some of the things that some of us have been doing at the Institute. And you will see from the list of people, you will see that most of the people here are not biologists. So Gabriele Alexe is a statistician. I'm supposedly a physicist. Babu is a chemist. Gustavo is another physicist. And Arnie Levine is the sole biologist. And Arnie kind of keeps us clean and makes sure we do things that are meaningful and relevant. But the ultimate goal of any such research should be actually to get things into medical practice rather than just publish papers and get accolades for yourself. So we've been focusing mainly on making statements that are valid and demonstrable and complementing the things that biologists could do on their own. Okay, so Herbert also told me, so anything wrong with this talk is Herbert's fault. Herbert also told me that nobody here, with the exception of Boris, knows biology. So if you do know biology, I apologize to you. I am going to give a brief introduction to all of cell biology, and then I'll tell you what mass spectrometry is, and I will describe gene arrays in some, not in too much detail. And then I'll tell you why we're doing this. And then I'll describe something which we call a pattern-based metaclassifier. And that's where all the statistical concepts that all of you are familiar with will come out, and you'll see that, oh, this stuff is easy. And then I'll show you results from two case studies, one on prostate cancer and the other from follicular lymphoma and DLBCL. Okay, so start from the beginning. We are all made of cells, and a cell is composed of many parts. There are many kinds of cells. You can see examples of cells down below, and basically the cells and the proteins they express define every piece of your body and define every organism. So the first thing to learn in molecular biology is how do cells make protein? And so very quickly, for the human, there are 22 autosomal chromosomes and one sex chromosome, and they're paired. You get half of them from your half of more or less half of it from your mother and half of it from your father, unless you're female. In that case, you also get half from the father and half from the mother, but not quite the same half. The language of the genome is in terms of four bases, A, C, G, T, except for RNA, and RNA has a different language. But you don't really need to know the biological details except just the letters. So it's like a four-letter code, but it's not even a four-letter code, it's a two-letter code, because A only pairs with T most of the time, and G only pairs with C most of the time. So it's really written in terms of two letters, which are two pairs of binary letters. The fifth one is for RNA. RNA replaces thymine with uracil. for some reason that nobody knows, it's probably buried in our ancestral past. At some point, RNA world changed into DNA world, and somehow U got changed to T, and we have been living with it ever since. Okay, so there are 20 amino acids. So proteins are made out of amino acids, long chains of amino acids, and the genome codes for specific proteins in triplets. And this little chart shows you what the triplets stand for. So a U on a, you're supposed to read it, a first codon, second codon, and the third codon is listed in the right-hand column. So a UUU is phenylalanine. UCU is serine, and so on. And you can see that the code is degenerate. And you can also see, if you stare at it long enough, that the first two letters are more important than the last one. So you can make an error in the last codon, but not in the first two. And usually an error in the first two codons results in a change in the amino acid, but in the last one, usually it doesn't really matter. And there are some codons which are listed as stop codons, and these are the ones that are terminating signals. So when whatever it is that reads the RNA, when the ribosome reads the messenger RNA, it comes to the stop codon, and then it knows that that's, you're done, basically. So it's like a full stop. Okay, so the way transcription happens is that, I didn't have a picture of the copying, but essentially what happens is that inside your nucleus, the chromosomes are opened, and they are copied. I think I have here it is. So inside the nucleus, the chromosomes are copied, they are the sequence that corresponds to some gene is transcribed in the form of an mRNA, and then the mRNA before it leaves the nucleus actually is broken up into pieces, which are mRNA doesn't consist of continuous information. There are pieces which have information and pieces which are garbage, and the garbage is excised out of the information, and then they are stuck back together to make a single piece, which makes the full mRNA, which actually exits the nucleus and enters into a structure called the ribosome, which is shown down here. And it is read in units of three. And as it is read in units of three, there are specialized RNA called tRNA, which also floating around in the cytoplasm, which enter and they recognize the signal. And on the other side of them are attached the amino acids that will make the polypeptide chain that comes snaking out of the ribosome, as you can see up there. So it's quite a complex machinery, which is involved in making proteins. And then as the protein comes out of the ribosome, it folds and goes about doing whatever it's supposed to be doing. Okay, so now if you were a cell biologist, or if you wanted to relate what's happening in the cell to something functional, you could work either at the level of the protein. So if you knew which proteins were synthesized in what amounts, that could be a signal for whatever is happening in the cell. But another way of doing this would be if you knew how much mRNA there was, or what kind of mRNA there was. That's another way to figure out what's going on in the cell. So I'm going to talk about both things. It turns out it's much easier to work with mRNA than with proteins, because mRNA are complementary to mRNA. And you already have the double helix. Whereas with proteins, to figure out how much protein there is a non-trivial job. So I will show you that there are actually chips that you can make which will tell you very accurately what mRNA levels there are in the cell. There are very few chips. They're just beginning to be made now. Okay. So this is a picture of the ribosome. So now I've already told you what the cell, so that's the end of cell biology. If you have a question, you can ask now. There are no exams, so I guess everybody will pass. Oh, because you have this binary code. So if you make a complementary sequence, you take a random set of sequences, or you take sequences from known genes themselves, and you can synthesize them in the lab, or pieces of sequences, then you can actually see the hybridization of these two existing mRNA in the cell. Well, because it's unique. Yeah, it's sticky. You know exactly what the interactions are. Proteins interact in other ways, with electrostatic interactions, and they have all sorts of funny shapes, whereas mRNA is a linear thing and sticks in a linear way.
And there are many mRNAs of the same type, and the concentration in the cell is rather similar.
No, no. The assumption, okay, no, of course not. There is a regulatory system which actually people are just. Experimentally, what you do, you crush the cell. I will show you the procedure you follow. In fact, that's the next few slides. So there has been a revolution in this field largely because of one simple thing. And I wanted to emphasize this just to show you that physics, it's trivial physics, is involved here. You know, this was a big deal in biology. But essentially what they're doing is they take a strand of DNA and they heat it up. And heating, of course, dissociates the two strands. And then you add a prime, forward and reverse primers, which is random sequences, 12 to 18 base pairs long. And these things will hybridize to their complement on the two separate strands. And then you allow the machinery in the cell to add reverse transcriptase, which will extend the places where the RNA complement is not completed. And then you keep doing this cycling over and over and over again. And you can amplify a very small piece of DNA into a big signal. And since you know the rate at which it gets amplified, you can actually monitor the rate at which it gets amplified. You can calibrate it and monitor it. And so you know what amplification you've done. And so if then you can you measure the amount at the end of the amplified stuff, you know what it started out as. So without this, of course, the minute amounts of mRNA would never be translatable into anything real. But with this, they're translatable. OK. Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah. So you have a small amount of this stuff. Yeah, you break it, you open it up, you complete it, so you get twice as much, and then you open it up again. So you go through a heating and annealing cycles, and then eventually you will get a big signal from what started out to be a tiny signal. So this is used in things like looking at Neanderthal DNA and figuring out what the exact proportion of different genes is, or even just to get any signal at all, you need to do this. Oh, that's coming. That's coming. You can get you can get huge amplification factors. Not 2^30, 2^12 or 13 is typical. So it's huge, thousands. Okay, so the process that identifies what's going on is kind of summarized in this slide. So you start with gene chip. You start with something coated with polylysine, and you take. So in this case, this shows an example of yeast. Yeast, it turns out, has 6,000 on the order of 6,000 genes, and ORF means open reading frame. So you take the yeast open reading frame. You take a little bit of yeast. You crush it. And you amplify the genes by PCR, like what was described in the previous transparency, and then you deposit this on you separate the genes and you deposit them on the surface, and the polylysine actually adheres to the DNA, and then you heat this deposited tray to denature the DNA. So then the DNA is single strand, it's stuck on the polylysine, and it's just kind of sitting there. And now, if you want to, so this is the experimental setup. These are called probes, the stuff that is in the on the slide. All it is for every gene, they have little fragments of the DNA of this gene. Usually, it's not full fragments, it's pieces. And how you select the pieces, there's a whole industry for how you select the pieces, because you want to select them so they don't cross-hybridize, but that's all detail. And you want to select them so that they're specific to the gene that you want to look for. So you have to find the right sequence on every gene which is unique to that gene and is cannot be mistaken for a similar sequence on a different gene. Okay, but that, all that can be done. Now, if you want to compare two strains, so let's say one is yeast with cancer and yeast without cancer, or yeast which is in some stressed state, say you've shocked it with temperature, or you've starved it by giving it no sugar for many, many weeks, and you want to compare which genes are now active in one and not in the other, you would take them and you would extract the RNA. Then you would attach to each strain. You would attach a different colored dye. So this is something which would shine with an appropriate color under laser, and you would then hybridize these with the spotted deposit on the plate for on the order of 12 hours, so that these things get a chance to float around and find their complement and hybridize to the complement. And then you wash off. Later on, you wash off the whatever is left of the liquid that you poured on, and then you use a laser to look at each spot on the chip to see how much was hybridized. And the presumption is that the proportion of stuff hybridized is proportional to how much there was in the original cell. So if you have more green than red for a certain gene, it means that gene is expressed higher in the green or the red. And then the ratio of the amount of green to red, for example, would give you the ratio of the expression levels of that specific gene in that cell. So it's as simple as that. And the end of the analysis is you get an image which looks like this, which is then read into a computer, and all you see is an Excel file which gives you ratios of expressions of different genes. So it's an industry now, and the industry is pretty good at giving you this. It's even not very expensive. And so then what do? You plot the green intensity versus the red intensity, and you plot the genes for the two types of species. And of course, there is a cone in the middle which you eliminate because the cell has normal variation of genes anyway. And also, you have experimental error. So there's a whole industry to figure out why and what part of this you should eliminate. And that's also where physicists and statisticians and mathematicians have contributed a great deal. There's a good understanding of, in fact, there are invariant ways in which you can study this error. The error has an invariant distribution which you can measure, and you can eliminate the error. And then whatever is outside the error is then taken to be a signal. And then you look at the signal and you say, okay, so these genes are up, these genes are down. So now I know what's going on in the cell. Okay? You're trying to find out you're trying to compare two cells with two different in two different conditions. And you're looking at in a given gene, you know, which genes are up or down regulated in these two cells. And that presumably is related to the difference between these cells functionally. So if one was a cancer cell for humans and the other was a normal cell, then these would be genes that are expressed by the cancer or repressed by the cancer. And those presumably are the genes that cause the disease or are a consequence of the disease. I mean, all the biology is still to be figured out, but at least you get a picture of what's going on in the cell. So think of this as a high-energy physics experiment that tells you, okay, if I shoot at the proton with another proton at a certain energy, then stuff comes flying out. And this just tells you what stuff comes flying out. The interpretation is still, you still have to interpret. What does it mean? So I'm going to show you how we interpret what it means next.
What are the data points along the axis?
Oh, it's the intensity.
No, there's some data points there.
Oh, the circular marked data points.
No, the other one.
In here. Oh, these points. Yeah, so these are presumably other genes that are. Yeah, this is the danger of getting a slide from the internet. I have no idea. So those are genes which are overexpressed. You know, and so they should also be circled as important genes. Yeah. So these are presumably that's a signal. No, they all hybridize, right? So this is a signal for a real gene. So this is presumably some gene that in one of the cells was highly suppressed, but in another was highly expressed. Yeah. So. At some unit of intensity, how much red there is or how much green there is presumably proportional to how much gene there is and how much gene there is, okay, how much of one or the other there is. So there's a whole way to calibrate this. There's a whole industry to calibrate this using known genes.
So there are 6,000 different points.
Yes, there will be 6,000 different points. For one sample, there will be 6,000 points. Points. So there will be 6,000 wells in this chip in the spotting chip. There will be 6,000 wells. Each of them will contain a fragment of gene, which is specific to a fragment of a gene which identifies that gene. And then you'll do this experiment, and then you'll scan the thing, and it'll tell you how much red there was, which means how much was this gene expressed in the red strain, and how much was this gene expressed in the green strain. And then what the readout gives you is the ratio of the two. Actually, it gives you a log of the ratio of the two. And then you plot it on that chart. So if it goes along the middle, it's just noise. You know, it's almost the same. In fact, this curve is drawn incorrectly, because it turns out that the universal curve goes along like this. That anything in here is an error. It turns out that it's the so if you look at this distribution, the width of this distribution divided by the average value of the expression has a universal distribution, which is a Gaussian, and you know this universal distribution. If you repeat this experiment 5 times, you'll know this universal distribution, and you can use it to actually eliminate the noise from the signal. So you can put a p-value, and you can do all sorts of good things, but in the end you come up with some genes which are functionally significant, which seem to be overexpressed or underexpressed in the two in a systematic way. Okay, so let me go on, and then you'll see what. Okay, so there are lots of detailed protocols that if you really want to do this, you can go there and you can read all about it. So, but it turns out that this is not the. Although this, what I just showed you, was the original invention of Botstein's, where he actually now it's in Stanford. Pat Brown is the person now who runs this lab now that David Botstein is gone. But that was the original way in which gene chips started. But now, of course, there's a business associated with this, and Affymetrix found a way to use photolithography to do this much more efficiently, and so they've more or less taken over the industry. And since they have a monopoly, they charge incredible prices. But since NIH seems to have an unlimited budget, you know, everybody's happy. So what they do is they actually can synthesize oligomers with any sequence they want on the plate, on the chip. And they are actually, they use photolithography to actually stick them on. And yeah, it's just placed there. And you can place 10 to the 7 of them in one pixel of very specific sequence. Typically, they use 25 to 50 long base pair long sequences. And they actually, what they do is they have several copies of the same gene. And to eliminate error, to subtract error, they actually mutate some middle site. And the signal is the signal for the correct hybridization minus the signal on the one with the error. Of course, they don't tell you exactly which protocol they use. It's a secret. And I have worked on this, so I know that people suspect their final numbers, because if you repeat the experiment 10 times, you know, you get 10 different answers. And they're off sometimes by 25 to 30%, which can be significant if you're looking at something which is really marginally expressed in the first place. So people are not sure that this is really the right way to do things, but this is what we've got right now. So we have to live with that. In any case, yeah. No, but it's done very fast. There's a machine that does it. That it's done simultaneously in rows, so the whole rows get put in. Check, 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 check. Yeah, it's grown. No, it's grown there. It's grown there. There are wells, and you change the potential, and then you have a bath, and the potential attracts the correct base pair, and it just grows in that well. So you grow approximately 10 to the 7 strands in every well. And it's all computer controlled. You know, you just change the electrical potential to attract the right base pair, and then it just grows. Yes. Okay, and then you do the same experiment where you take a cell, you break down the mRNA of the cell into pieces, and you attach to them. This time you don't need two kinds of dye, but you need one, something which is excitable by a laser. You attach to that, back to the target, and then you hybridize this on top of the probes, and at the end what you have is this is the probe, the original one on the plate, and hybridized to it is its complement from the cell that you are studying, and of course under laser it lights up, and here of course there's no comparison, so it's the absolute level that you are measuring. It's not two cells, it's just one cell. Okay, and of course there are lots of places where you can download analysis tools, and I've just listed a few of them. Okay, so I'm going to talk about that and something new that has been out in the market for about a year and a half, which shows more promise than gene chips. This is mass spec, and as all of you have learned in the first class you probably took in physics, when you have a electric field and you accelerate an ion electric field, the time it takes to travel across from one place to the other is proportional to the charge and inversely proportional, or the other way around. The time it takes is proportional to the mass and inversely proportional to the charge. There's more force for the higher charge. So essentially what they do is they take serum, so they take a blood sample, you go to the doctor. This is the dream, right? You go to the doctor and go to your physical checkup, he makes you open your mouth and go, ah, and then he takes a little bit of blood, and then he puts your blood in a mass spec machine, and he has a genetic signature for all the diseases you currently have. Now, you may not like to know the results of this, but at least he knows, and it's good. He tells you you're fine, even if he doesn't do anything. The fact that he could have done something significant will already make you feel better. So I'm all for this. Is that how they analyze? Okay, but in this case, what is done is you take the blood and there's a dispenser which applies serum. So you remove serum from blood and you apply it to a surface of a protein binding chip, and then you use a laser to actually ionize the proteins that are bound to this chip. These ions are then accelerated down a chamber with a fixed electric field. And at the end, you measure the intensity and time of arrival of the ion. And that tells you, that gives you a spectrum. It gives you a signal which looks like this. So on the x-axis is plotted M over Z, and the y-axis is plotted how much stuff you got. So essentially, x-axis is a measure of the time, and the y-axis is a measure of the amplitude that you received at that time. And so that is your profile, protein profile. Okay, so why should any of this be useful at all? So now I'm going to show you some results based on data that you get using these two techniques. So, but before I do that, I want to tell you what my motivation for doing this is. And the motivation is that in spite of a lot of papers published by a lot of very eminent people, including physicists, if you go to a doctor, I've not seen any doctor who will first call up his favorite bioinformatician and ask him for an opinion. And I would like to have that happen as soon as possible, because we have proof that it's valuable to the medical profession. And yet the medical profession does not trust us. And I suspect the reason it does not is because we are so busy fighting ourselves, amongst ourselves, that we are not making an attempt to talk to them. So first thing we are trying to do is to work with people like the Broad Institute in Boston and people at NIH to actually go to area hospitals with the results that I'm going to show you and try to convince them that, you know, please put us in blind in studies, blind studies of patients. Give us samples, do the tests, you know, wait for 5 years and see if the patients progress to a disease that we predicted, and then open the envelope and check if we were right. But it hasn't happened yet. You know, pharmaceutical companies seem to be in control of this market to an incredible extent, and we need to break that deadlock. So I'll just give you an example of what bothers me. Is if you go to a pharmaceutical company and you say that I have figured out a way to prove that one of your drugs only works for 25% of the people, it doesn't work for the other 75%. Do you think they'll fund you for this? Of course not. Because you just slashed their profit by a factor of 4. So what they want is which drugs in what combinations will be more effective than the drugs we are using now. Because that means that they can treat you with more stuff than they're treating you now. And the only way to break the deadlock and have the doctors listen to you rather than to the pharmaceutical companies is to actually present them with an alternative. And in the case of certain cancers, that has happened, you know. But you only hear about this for simple things. And there is a gene called BRCA1 and BRCA2, which when mutated, causes breast cancer early. Okay, so this is well known. You can't hide this. It's so obvious in the data that pharmaceutical companies accept this. And it turns out that with one or the other gene, the treatment regimens are totally different. So you don't want to have chemotherapy and radiation therapy at the same time if one of them is not going to work on the tumor. You'd rather have one or the other. And so they've accepted this in some cases, but not in general. So we need to really break that. And I think good people with the kinds of background that you have entering into this field in a large quantity will force them to pay attention. So that's my hope. Yeah. Yeah, so I'm going to show you that. So why should he make anything of the M over Z? That's what I'm going to talk about. So I'm going to now talk about prostate cancer. Hopefully none of you will get it. But if you live long enough, you'll either die of prostate cancer if you're male, or you'll die of Alzheimer's. It's kind of almost 100%. The risk increases with age. There has been an increasing incidence since the 80s. Of course, you could also die of a brick falling on your head, but you have to go somehow. But I would rather not go this way. And the reason that the incidence is increasing since the 80s is largely because of more of screening. But as you know, the prostate is situated in a rather delicate place, and it's kind of awkward to do biopsy, and it's very awkward also to do surgery. And so you would rather know for sure that you don't have it, or that you do have it, so that you are sure that you need the treatment. So early detection is always a good thing. Accurate diagnosis is also very useful. Of course, accurate diagnosis also is useful because it translates into probability of cure almost directly. If you diagnose it early, before it has spread out of the lobes, you can get rid of it, and you have 100% recovery. If you don't diagnose it early and it spreads out, prognosis is low. Or digital rectal examination. It's just the...
Everybody will be on the same page.
And PSA, for the Alzheimer's patients in the audience, PSA stands for protein-specific antigen, prostate-specific antigen, sorry. So the names are trivial. Yeah. Oh, it's terrible. Should never do that. Don't let your wife hear that. Okay, so So the first question that people ask you if you go to the medical profession, hopefully will ask you, is that why should serum be a measure? If why should the blood have in it signals for a disease, for prostate cancer? And the reason is in this slide. The reason is that the cancer cell doesn't live in a closed environment. It actually communicates with the blood, and it modifies genetic pathways to create a survival advantage for itself. So there are proteins that it exchanges with the tumor environment. So there are proteins involved in growth and invasion, which are modified in the serum because of the fact that the pathway extends to the interface. So you should be able to see something, some signal in the serum. But of course, the signal you will see in the serum is not going to tell you why you have the cancer. It's just going to tell you that you do have the cancer. It's a diagnostic signal. It doesn't go to the cause of the cancer, but it's good enough to have early diagnosis. Okay, so what is the promise of this? You will get early detection, you'll get accurate staging, you'll get increased survival rates and cures. This is the usual motherhood and apple pie thing. But more important is that they may suggest better hormone therapy, because at the moment, the hormone therapies they use, over time, they fail, and you need surgery. So if you could find the better alternative treatments, you could modify the treatment as the disease progresses and keep people active and alive longer. Okay, so what we have done is we have constructed a classifier which takes the data and uses it as a tool to make predictions. And this summarizes the whole thing. So on the left-hand side, you get input data, which is first pre-processed. So you want to make some rule-based algorithm which will predict the phenotype. Phenotype is either cancer or non-cancer. And so for that, we process the data, and I will describe the steps that we use. After that, we select those M over Z values, which we call features, which have predictive use. Not all signals are valuable, because some of the signals are just routine. You know, there's something which is highly expressed, but that's functionally useful for the body just to do its normal thing. So you want to eliminate the stuff that is common between both phenotypes. And you could also, at this stage, you could include the biologists into the business and give them what they want. You know, they say, but I know that this pathway is involved. Okay, so you can use the M over Z values that are specific to that pathway. And then we feed in this information into not one, but many, many, many machine learning tools. I don't want to go through the discussion of whose machine learning tool is the best, because it's totally useless discussion. You know, does support vector machines work better than neural nets? Who cares, really? This is why I made that joke in the beginning. Who cares? If it is predictive, you should use it. If it's not predictive, you should throw it out. I remember that Arnie told me another thing. I told him that I have a way to prove that there are 20 amino acids. And again, he told me, who cares? There are 20. Just live with it. There's no point in trying to understand something which is a fact. In biology, it's known. You know, we know there are 20. Just move on. Yeah. Prostate-specific antigen. So there is one antigen that they found is overexpressed in the prostate, and so they gave it a name. But then they found that it's also, if you have breast cancer, you get males who have breast cancer. There are a few who have that, also express PSA highly. So it's not really, it's a marker for something, but it's not very specific. And high levels of PSA don't mean you have prostate cancer, you know. And if you have prostate cancer, you could have low levels of PSA. So monitoring it. If there is a big change in the levels of prostate cancer, it's a statement of the disease progression. But it's not a early diagnostic tool. Okay, so I'm going to take a whole bunch of machine learning tools, and I'm going to use something called pattern data, and eventually come up with a prediction which is much better than you would have if you missed some of these steps. And I will show you how well we can do with this. Okay, so let me first introduce a concept which we use called patterns. And I guess I've already probably run over my time. I have 15, 20 minutes? Okay. So think of this as feature one and feature two. Feature is the amplitude of a specific m over z value. So this is m over, say you pick an m over z equal 2,000, m over z equals 3,000. And each one of these dots is a patient in your training set. So a red dot is a normal patient, and a blue dot is a cancer patient. The axis is the amplitude of a specific m over z value. So it's a particular protein. How much of a particular protein is expressed in that patient? This is one protein. This is a different protein. And each dot is a patient. Right? So you can see that the blue dots like to be in this region. So if you could somehow get a sense of this region, you know, if you could make a function that encloses this region, this function could be predictive for that phenotype. You could say, if it falls in this region, it's cancer. If it falls outside this region, it's OK. And now imagine this feature space multiplied by 15,000, because there are 15,000 peaks in this M over Z signal. And so you are working in this 15,000 dimensional space, and each patient is a dot in this 15,000 dimensional space, and you have to characterize where the dots are and how they aggregate. Yeah? Oh, in mass? Yes, you can tell to two decimal places. So it's 2,000.74 Daltons. It's pretty accurate. That's how the data comes in. And there is a jitter. There is a noise, but the noise is supposed to be on the order of 1%. Oh, no, of course it is degenerate. Oh, yeah, sure. So there is things are phosphorylated and acetylated. Yes, so in fact, the signal you get is not 1 M over Z. It's related M over Z. So things which are close by. Yeah, so I'll show you what we do for that. We know that there is a jitter, so we actually smooth the data out over the jitter. Is that what you mean?
So how variable are patterns of the
Oh, of course it varies, yes. So mass spec, yeah, so that's one of the criticisms of mass spec, is that you don't get repeatable results. You have to actually do. So the serum changes, protein levels change a lot. But the presumption is that you can still see. I mean, I'll show you. Yeah, so that's a criticism. If you repeat the experiment, will you see the same signals? Experiments have not been repeated enough for me to be able to tell you for sure. But you're right that protein levels do change in serum. But how much they change, I don't know. Because you can reproduce, but not to 100% accuracy. You can reproduce to 25% accuracy. Right. Yes, certain proteins are, yeah, exactly. Yes, so this is not validated in that way. I haven't done repeated experiments on the same patient and shown that, okay, so because you get the data for free from NCBI and you live with what you get. And that is a known criticism for this method. But, you know, if you can prove that it's valuable, hopefully somebody will validate it using these tests. Okay. So the idea is to characterize phase space by making these clusters. And unfortunately, it's hard to make a cluster which has this funny shape. So instead, you make boxes. Okay, so you try to find cuts along the axes in such and make boxes along these cuts in such a way that the box encloses one or the other phenotype, and none of the, you know, there's no mixing of phenotypes in the box. So this shows you two such cases. Of three in this case and two over there of what we call patterns. So the patterns on the left are positive patterns. They enclose the cancer phenotype. And the patterns on the right are negative patterns. They enclose the normal phenotype. And then your model would be based on these patterns. You would say, suppose I draw all possible patterns, which include at least one, so that I make enough patterns so that all members of both phenotypes are at least in one pattern. So then I have a model that says, OK, this list of patterns, which can be represented as a binary vector, classifies the data into one phenotype or the other. OK, and so if you take your data and you, let me do that later. If you take your pattern data and you take your cases in the training set and plot the patterns on the x-axis, And the patients that satisfy these patterns on the y-axis, you can see the kind of results you get. So you can see that on top you have the cancer patients, and they all fall into the positive patterns. Some of them don't fall into a pattern, and so you don't, you know, it's blank. But by and large, you can see that there is a clustering of patterns for positive cases and a clustering of patterns for negative cases. And then there's a region in the middle which have cases that are not classified by my patterns, at least in this picture. Of course, I could increase the number of patterns and force the classification to happen. And on the right-hand side, you can see the test cases. You can see that clearly the ones on top fall into the positive category. The ones on the bottom, down below, fall into the negative category. And there's some ambiguity in the middle, which is where all the action is anyway. So those are the poor guys where the doctor says, well, there's a chance that you need to do another biopsy. Painful enough the first time, and it's even worse the second time. But okay, so the algorithm we use, since this is a physics talk, so I should tell you at least about one algorithm. It's an algorithm that finds all patterns in a time which is linear in the number of patterns. And the way you do that is you start by making a box around every data, which doesn't include any other patient. And then you extend these boxes. So you make these two lists. These are minimal lists. And then you try to combine the boxes by taking one from this and every possible one from the same list and join them and check to see that none of the other phenotype is inside. And if you can do that, then you put that in a new list. So you make this new list, and then you add from the original list onto the new list. You make a next list and so on until the lists stop growing, and then you're done. So you get all possible boxes and of all possible shapes, but square shapes. Okay, so now let me show you some results. So we took from the website that is shown above, we took the data on prostate cancer. There were 253 cases of normal people. Yeah. Okay. In the number of patterns. So. Well, in the number of. No, it goes linearly in the number of patients, but the number of patterns is infinitely. Obviously, it's two to the n. But not all patterns satisfy the condition that they should not have the other phenotype. So the number of patterns that. Yes.
So
as the number of patients.
The quadratic in number of patients.
It's quadratic in the number of patients, and it's linear in the number of patterns you can get out of it. So the number of patterns can be two to the n. If you combine two boxes, so it starts by making two boxes, right? So you'll have two patients in the first step. Then you will add a third patient, if you can add it. So it'll make all boxes which can have three patients, and then all boxes that can have four patients. And clearly, this will terminate at some point because the space will. If you have two separate lobes, clearly you can make an infinite. No, there are two patients whose phenotype is known. So you only combine them if the phenotype is known. And so we only care about patterns that have the most number of patients. You get all boxes which have the most number of, which can be extendable. You get a box along every dimension which has the most number of patients before it hits someone from the other phenotype. So I want to make patterns that are as big as possible, which encompass as much of the phenotype as possible in every dimension. And it'll get that.
So in the previous graph, how did you rank the patients?
I sorted them by how many patterns they satisfied. You mean from top to bottom? Yes, how many positive patterns they satisfied. And then how many negative patterns they satisfied was from down up. Yeah, it was carefully chosen to. Yes. Yes. Oh, this is used as input into the support vector machines. This is just the pre-processing. So I have not even come to the, if I can get 10 minutes more, I can explain really what I do very quickly. Okay, so first thing we do is we do pre-processing, which is you, this is to answer Boris's question, is the data comes with baseline subtracted, the peaks are aligned. You first remove 1/3 of the data to do testing and train on 2/3. You normalize and smooth them as usual to make all the things go from 0 to 1. Then we also estimate sample noise. So in this case, of course, after we've normalized, the sample noise is 1, but we force it to be 1. So we are aware that it's 1. And I'm going to use later on sample noise to actually validate the results. And then, so this is what happens. You get a raw spectrum like this. You normalize it, you get a different spectrum. And the reason this spectrum looks different from that one is because it's normalized relative to every other patient. Okay, so the normalization factor you apply to every M over Z is different. Okay, and then we smooth this because we know that the machine has a jitter, and also we know that on the order of 5 or 6 M over Z values are really the same protein. So what you do is on each M over Z value, you make a little Gaussian, and you average using that Gaussian as a weight. And the width of the Gaussian is 5 on one side, 5 on the other. Okay, so after you do that, we do first univariate filtering. So we first find those M over Z values which are most correlated with the phenotype using a sequence of tests. And we only select those features that pass all our tests, which means that they are all predictive. They have some predictive content. And if you do that, out of the 15,000, you have only 512 M over Z values. Okay. Then it turns out that the peptides with nearby M over Z values, even in our sample, are highly correlated across the patients. That's a signal that they could be either in the same pathway or, more likely, they're probably the same protein. And so these are lumped together because they are not really different. So we bin them, and in the end, we get 39 bins. Okay, and then finally, on these 39 bins, we create a large collection of patterns, as I showed you before. And then we sort the bins by how often they are in the pattern. Got it? Every one of the bins is a feature, is an M over Z value. And I make patterns using them. Of course, every box encloses all features. But if it only encloses one measurement along that dimension, then it doesn't count. 39. In this example, it's 39-dimensional space. And so you make the boxes, and you say, how many patterns, positive patterns, let's say, a specific M over Z value is in? And you sort them by how many patterns they are in. So the ones that are in lots of patterns have good prediction. The ones that are in a few patterns are not very useful. And then what we do is we iterate this until we have a relatively small number of bins. So we throw out M over Z values, do the patterns again until you get a small number of bins. We actually also monitor using weighted voting. We monitor the specificity and the sensitivity as a function of the number of bins. And that actually goes up and then starts to go down. So we take the peak. And then finally, we have a support set which has only 11 M over Z values, and this shows you which 11 they are. So these are M over Z values which are 95% confidence limit. And you can see that they are very close, 9217, 9220. They're pretty close in M over Z. And this is a typical representative M over Z value, and this is how many were included in the bin. And this shows you the average intensity of cancer levels and non-cancer levels. So this is a typical example of a pattern for a specific M over Z value. You can see the blues are all the non-cancer patients, and the reds are all the cancer patients. And so this is one pattern, which is, in this case, the positive pattern also encloses some negatives, but we allow that. And this is the real data from the prostate cancer patients that we analyzed. Again, you can see that there are obvious cases, and then there are the ones that are not so obvious. So now we take these patterns and we use them as input into a number of machine learning tools. And since I have no time left, I will not go over the... Okay, so we use several machine learning tools, and at the end of that, you get something that looks like this, where... So this I will explain in some detail. In the columns, ANN stands for neural nets, SVM stands for support vector machine, KNN stands for k-nearest neighbor. And if you want, afterwards I can give you details about how these things work. But essentially, you train either on pattern data or you train on raw data using those M over Z either as values or as a pattern vector in pattern space. And you use each of these machine learning tools on the training data, and the column shows you the sensitivity and the specificity for the training set. And then you create a weight vector for each of these machine learning tools by taking the sensitivity, subtracting 50, taking the specificity and subtracting 50, and normalizing it so that the total weight is 1. So if something is not sensitive, you won't use it. If something is sensitive, you'll use it. It's just as bad the other way. It's just as bad the other way. It's much worse to tell him that he doesn't... Well, it's much worse to tell him he doesn't have cancer. Is that what you said? Yeah, but it's equally bad to tell him he does have cancer when he actually doesn't. Because and doctors do that very often. Because, see, if I tell you that, hey, Philip, you're sick. I need to operate on you. I operate on you, then you say, what? No. But yes, I that's true. But suppose second opinion says the same thing. In that case, you get operated and you're cured, but you didn't have the damn thing in the first place. So it's both ways is horrible. Yeah. So you want to eliminate error as much as you can. Oh, because it was not very good. It had almost no predictive power for this data set. You know, there are people who argue and argue and argue, and the literature is full of this. It says, oh, but SVM should work. Why doesn't it? Well, it doesn't work in this case. You know, biology doesn't have to conform to our presumption that we can describe this stuff using SVM. I mean, it just doesn't work. So move on. Let's just use whatever works. We'll use it. Right. It's a toss of the coin. The linear kernel seems to be unpredictive. Okay, so this is a better summary of the results. So here, each of the dots is a patient, right, on the x-axis, and on the y-axis are the different classifiers, either the on raw data or on pattern data. The reds are the errors, and the blues are accurate predictions. And on the bottom you see is our meta-classifier, which is a summary of all the results from each of these classifiers. You can see it only makes one error right here. But that error is consistent across all the machine learning tools. So this poor guy, so this is normal. So this poor guy was told he was OK, but he was not OK, at least from our point of view. So it would be nice if we could intercept the patient at this stage and tell the doctor that, you know, maybe it looks OK to you, but we would like a second opinion. So at least if this was used to generate a second opinion, this poor guy would have been diagnosed. But what probably happens is that he goes home, he's told he's fine. 2 years later, he comes back, he has prostate cancer. And the doctor says, gee, well, you didn't have it when I saw you last time. And what can you do? There's nothing you can do. Equally bad is this case, I guess, which is somebody who was diagnosed to have it and didn't have it. In that case, he was cured. These two guys were probably cured. And of course, our meta-classifier is not sensitive to error. We redid the whole analysis using noise, and there's no change. But you expect that because the filtering was initially done, including noise. And so clearly, it's not sensitive to noise. OK, so I'm done with half of my talk, but at this point, probably I should stop. But yeah, so let me skip to the end. I just want to show you one kind of result that we can get. So since I work with Arnie, I should show you some P53 stuff. Okay, so P53 is a gene which is like a policeman in the cell. And I'm sure Arnie told you about this when he was here. So P53 is, it checks cell integrity, checks again for DNA damage, and there's a whole sequence of things it can put into motion if it finds that there's something wrong with the cell. It could put into place a repair mechanism, and if the repair mechanism works, then the cell will continue as normal. But if the repair mechanism fails and P53 keeps on alarmed, then the cell will be induced to commit suicide. Okay, so when P53 gets mutated, many cells, the cell typically progresses towards cancer. You need two mutations, but this is one of them. And so P53 and its related genes are usually used as important markers. And so we took a support set of 90 P53 responsive genes, which was selected based on the pattern criterion that I showed you before. And this was in the case of a cancer called follicular lymphoma, which is a cancer caused by a translocation of a gene which is useful to make receptors for B cells. It translocates to some other place in the genome where it actually interferes with cell. It mutates in somatic cells, causing them to become weird. So follicular lymphoma is a disease of the B cells. But if it progresses, it actually can become an organ-wide disease. And then in this case, it is called diffuse large B cell lymphoma. And follicular lymphoma is indolent, but DLBCL, if left untreated, will kill you in 2 years. So doctors really want to know how to monitor progression. In fact, when I gave a talk, once the guy, somebody from the audience came up to me and asked me many questions. He seemed to know a lot about the subject. So I asked him if he was a biologist, and he said, no, I have follicular lymphoma. And so it really brings home the point that this is real stuff, really affecting real people. So anyway, we took there are 400 genes that are known to be P53 responsive. We took them, and we found the ones that are most in patterns, and these are the ones that are most in patterns. If you analyze these, you get all sorts of, oh yeah, so you get, if you analyze these and you look at which patterns are the most predictive, here's the kind of results that you can show to the pharmaceutical industry and to doctors. You can say that if you just take P53 by itself, in fact, it has no predictive power. If we found that P53 by itself has almost no predictive power. But P53 in combination with two other genes, PLK1 and CDK2, is predictive at the 80% level. So if less than or equal to one of these, if only one of these is overexpressed, at most one, then you have an 80% chance of being normal. You're okay. You might have a follicular lymphoma, but you haven't progressed. Whereas if two or more are upregulated, you have an 80% chance that you have progressed. So this is a good marker. It's an easy marker. And this is the kind of stuff that should go into medical practice. And then, of course, once we've discovered this, we looked at the literature and we found that PLK1 has just recently been recognized to be a cancer marker. In fact, the paper is not yet published. So when we did this, it was in December of last year. And this paper was already on the internet to be published in 2005 in February. So they beat us, but they beat us by being ahead of us. You can't beat someone who's in the future, who's published already in the future. Okay, so at least what we are finding is real. It's not as if we are finding weird stuff. This is stuff that people are finding in labs other than ours using just pure biological methods. Okay, so what are the next steps? So for the mass spec results, the next steps are to relate the M over Z values to real pathways. Because one of the criticisms of all of this is that it doesn't make sense for biology. If you ask Arnie, they'll say, well, you guys are finding all sorts of genes and we have no clue what they're doing. And it might be that biologists are stupid, but I don't think so. I think that there is noise, there is a lot of error in the data, biology is not completely understood, and the human body is a complex thing. The systems are not the same. They have different levels at which they stabilize in different people. So there's a lot of fluctuation within the population. It's important to figure out what M over Z values are related to which pathways and try to understand in some high level what this means. So that's what we're going to try to do. We are going to also extend this meta-classifier approach to multi-phenotype classification. And what I mean by that is there are some diseases that you, colon cancer sometimes metastasizes to the lungs and sometimes metastasizes to the liver and sometimes doesn't. So when you operate, if you could have a marker which can predict metastases, then you would go through aggressive therapy. Whereas if you knew that, okay, this is not going to metastasize, you got the whole thing, there's a signal inside the cancer which says it's not going to metastasize, then you would probably, you know, not be so aggressive. So if you could do this for real and convince the medical community, it would be of benefit to people. And finally, of course, you want to convince some medical person to take you seriously. And for that, you need to do a lot more. You need to do blind studies and so on. So that's what we're trying to do. Okay, well, thank you very much. And so this is a Zen temple. In Kamakura. Yeah, there's a, well, they wear this, you know, it's because of pollen. Yes, Boris. No, some bins contain few. Yes. Yes. Ribosomal proteins, yeah. No, I didn't say that. No, not only that. PSA doesn't show up. Forget about P53.
The abundance isn't there.
Yes.
If you're looking at secondary, basically almost morphological differences between the cells, the chances are those long.
Yes.
Ribosomes, they go fast. So, why do you really care? How can you hope to take track it back to the pathway? Why do you want to go back to pathway? As long as you can tell the point. For medical purposes, it's more accurate pathology.
Well, I'm not sure. If you look at this database, it won't tell you, for example, what the consequence of the diagnosis were. Were these patients actually, did they get operated? Were they treated with? So you could correlate this with progression of disease. Not necessarily. So first of all, first claim is it could be diagnostic.
With the diagnostic value.
Yeah.
Just as looking at cells, looking at tissue in a microscope,
Yeah, why should you? So you're saying.
Transmission can tell, bad cell from a good cell.
Right.
It's fuzzy or something, right?
Yes.
So you can have a computer make a similar judgment by looking at some pathway.
Yes.
In fact, basically. An old colleague of mine, for many, many years, is a global possible source of material. So, very simple thing. If you put a little probe into a place where the light doesn't shine usually, well, it turns out that it can sort of see enough to the tissue that he can actually get the measurement of.
But by then it's probably. Yeah.
And, he's looking at the
gross
at,
things.
100 wavelengths.
Yeah.
And apparently he could.
But I don't know the staging, Boris.
Between
Yeah, so I don't know the staging value.
Sure, you can make a diagnosis and you don't have to go back
to... Well, I'm not sure you can make a diagnosis because you saw that there was diagnosis that was done, presumably with biopsy, and the diagnosis seemed to be wrong, at least in our analysis of this. So there are obvious things that we can see. I'm not so sure. So I would like to go through this exercise that you are just suggesting. It would be worth. It's necessary to do this, and it's worthwhile. But the trouble is that we don't have the data to do it. I would be very happy to validate this at any level to figure out at what level the signal is relevant, and you know above which the signal is really meaningless. So is it useful for staging? Can you do this for early detection? For that you need a huge amount of data, and there just isn't any data available. At least not publicly available. There is a lot of data, but people tend to keep the data like this. I don't know if you tried when you were at Rutgers. Did you try to work with the Rutgers hospital? It's very difficult because it's almost impossible, you know, because they guard the data like this. You go to them and you say, we can predict things and they don't want to talk to you about it. Yes, sir. The last, okay. Okay.
And I would tend to be related to measurement by another device.
Okay.
Not so much in another situation, for the purpose of diagnosis and pain.
Okay.
And things were where when we are feeling confronted of the thoughts and our ability to generate.
But that's a comment, but it's valuable to have a second opinion. Okay, thank you.